Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Dana Daman, Rajadaman,
Rajadaman, Mokshadaman,
Vakasha, Sri Daman,
Bhagavat
Daman,
Sanasa, Vyasa, Yogata.
Dana Daman, Rajadaman,
Rajadaman, He then explained by divisions, acts of charity, the pragmatic activities of the moon, and activities for salvation. Then he described the duties of women and devotees, both briefly and extensively. The taxation law was simple. There was no force, no encroachment. The king had a right to take 1/4 of the production made by the subject. The king had a right to claim 1/4 of one's allotted wealth. One would never grudge party with it, because due to the pious king and religious harmony, there was enough natural wealth, namely grains, fruits, flowers, silk, cotton, milk, jewels, minerals, and so forth. And therefore no one was materially unhappy. The citizens were rich in agriculture and animal husbandry, and therefore they had enough grains, fruits, and milk, without any artificial needs of soaps and toilets, cinemas and bars. The king had to see that the reserved energy of humanity was properly utilized. Human energy is meant not exactly for fulfilling animal propensities, but for self-realization. The whole government was specifically designed to fulfill this particular purpose. As such, the king had to select properly the cabinet ministers, but not on the strength of voting background. The ministers, the military commanders, and even the ordinary soldiers were all selected by personal qualification. And the king had to supervise them properly before they were appointed to their respective posts. The king was especially vigilant to see that the tapasvis, or persons who sacrifice everything for disseminating spiritual knowledge, were never disregarded. The king knew well that the supreme personality of God had never tolerated any insult to his unloyal devotees. Such tapasvis were trusted leaders, even of the rogues and thieves, who would never disobey the orders of tapasvis. The king would give special protection to illiterates, the helpless, and widows of the state. Defense measures were arranged previous to any attack by the enemies. The taxing process was easy, and it was not meant for squandering, but was for strengthening the reserve fund. The soldiers were recruited from all parts of the world, and they were trained for specific duties. As far as salvation is concerned, one has to conquer the principles of lust, anger, unlawful desires, avarice, and evil. To get freedom from anger, one should learn how to forgive. To be free from unlawful desires, one should not make plans. By spiritual culture, one is able to conquer sleep. By tolerance only can one conquer desires and avarice. Disturbances from various diseases can be avoided by regulated diets. By self-control, one can be free from false hopes. And money can be saved by avoiding undesirable associations. By practice of yoga, one can control hunger. And worldliness can be avoided by cultivating the knowledge of impermanence. Dizziness can be conquered by rising up. And false arguments can be conquered by factual ascertainment. Talkers of this can be avoided by gravity and silence. And by prowess, one can avoid fearfulness. Perfect knowledge can be attained through self-cultivation. One must be free from lust, avarice, anger, dreaming, and so forth to actually attain the path of salvation. As far as the women in class are concerned, they are accepted as a power of inspiration for men. As such, women are more powerful than men. It's the Hare Krishna teaching. Women are more powerful. People don't know our real teachings. Mighty Julius Caesar was controlled by a Cleopatra. Such powerful women are controlled by shyness. Therefore, shyness is important for women. Once this control valve is loosened, women can create havoc in society by adultery. Adultery means production of unwanted children, known as varnasankara, who disturb the world. The last item taught by Vishnu Dev was the process of pleasing the Lord. We are all eternal servants of the Lord, and when we forget this essential part of our nature, we are put into material conditions of life. The simple process of pleasing the Lord, for the householders especially, is to install the deity of the Lord at home. By concentrating on the deity, one may progressively go on with the daily routine work. Worshipping the deity at home, serving the devotee, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, residing in the holy place, and chanting the holy name of the Lord are all inexpensive items by which one can please the Lord. Thus the subject matter was explained by the grandfather. Om Ganatan Vandasat, Ganan Janasvara, Chakshu, Nandi, Parasakshu, Once again, we're speaking yesterday about division. There's no sense in trying to approach the world by establishing false equality and pretending that differences aren't there. So, Vishwadeva is explaining how to recognize material differences so that spiritual advancement can happen. In other words, although material differences are temporary, and although they are not the real thing, the spiritual reality is the real thing. Nevertheless, if you don't know how to use material differences, you will not attain the spiritual realm. This logic is explained very nicely by Shukracharya to Bali Maharaj. Although Shukracharya had wrong purpose, his purpose was to stop Bali Maharaj from giving charity and vision. Nevertheless, Shukracharya did say some correct points, although misapplied in his word judgment. Shukracharya explained that from a tree comes fruit and flowers. If you neglect to take care of the tree, then you don't get the fruits and flowers. Similarly, although the real goal in life is self-realization, you need this body to practice religion so that you can achieve self-realization. Therefore, if you neglect taking care of the body properly, you won't be able to achieve the goals of self-realization. Just like if you neglect to take care of the tree, you won't get the fruits and flowers that come from the tree. In the purport, Prabhupada explains that even in your pursuit of the truth, you require some of the untruth. So the body is untruth, in that in asat, it is temporary, achit, ignorant, and nirananda, miserable. But although the body is untruth, it is required to achieve the supreme, it is required to have to achieve truth. That's the great mystery of Bhakti Yoga. Real renunciation how everything is used in the service of the Lord, so that even matter acquires its proper significance and perspective. We don't just look at the world and dismiss it as false. We try to use everything for Krishna's pleasure. And that requires guidance and intelligence. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to show you that even fighting can be used for Krishna's pleasure. Therefore, Krishna did not let Arjuna off the hook. No, you can fight for me. Of course, there must be guidance. It's not that you can whimsically do anything and say it's all for Krishna. If you're actually a devotee, you want to excel at the art of pleasing Krishna. That requires some direction and guidance. Arjuna certainly achieved that guidance in Bhagavad Gita. He presented himself before Krishna and said, "Friendly talks are over. Now I'm your disciple, I'm a soul surrendered to you, please instruct me." Once Arjuna approached Krishna for guidance, then the Lord explained Yukta Vairagya. Don't walk off from the battlefield. That's not the spiritual thing to do. The spiritual thing is to fight, not thinking of me. Mama Nishmara Vidyancha. That was Arjuna's perfection. To fight, you have to be angry. You cannot fight without anger. But that anger was perfectly engaged in Krishna's service. Bhishma Dev is instructing Yudhisthira how to make divisions so that people can make progress back to God. Bodies are different. People are operating under different influences of the laws of nature. So, in order that they can get the maximum benefit, you have to recognize those differences. The whole Vedic way of civilization is one that recognizes differences and uses those differences so that everyone gets to be platformed beyond material differences. Therefore, you're hearing all these dharmas. Dana dharma, Raja dharma, Moksha dharma, Stri dharma, Bhagavat Dharma, all these different occupational activities. In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains to Arjuna that you cannot avoid this fight. That is not dharma. You have your dharma according to your Vedic occupational classification. By the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is pointing out, besides your temporary Vedic occupational classification, there is the real dharma simply doing something because I want it. So that is why the Lord at the end of Bhagavad Gita says, "Sarva dharma vrishya." Just abandon all the other lesser dharmas, whether they're bona fide Vedic dharmas or concocted dharmas, abandon them all, because what is actually the point of dharma? To do what I want. That is the real dharma. And all the subordinate temporary dharmas like Stri dharma or Raja dharma, Dana dharma, women's dharma, or king's dharma, or charity dharma. They're all meant for Bhagavad dharma. That's the goal. So, the differences are recognized by the various subordinate dharmas. And the whole point is that the temporary dharmas help you achieve the ultimate dharma, the real dharma, which is simply to do what Krishna wants. Now, the Lord says, yadayadayi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Whenever and wherever there's a decline in dharma, I come. Now, then why at the end of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying, sarva dharma, get rid of all the dharma. First he says, I come to establish dharma, and then he says at the end, get rid of all the dharma. So, Krishna is coming to establish real dharma. He demonstrates through his activities. I think we were reading a few days ago. Yes, our verse from the ninth canto of Vrishnavasthami Day, or the last verses of the ninth canto, that sets the stage for the tenth canto. This verse, which from it comes the whole tenth canto. In that verse, it is described that Krishna had his household pastimes, just to show householders how to live. So the Lord is demonstrating the temporary dharmas as well as the ultimate dharma. He's giving profound instruction about the ultimate dharma. And he's showing also how to act in society. At the same time, the Lord is showing, I am the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, although I'll show you how to be a perfect householder, I'm also a Padawan, so I've got 60,000 108 wives. Prabhupada was once explaining how he knew of one Nawab, Mohammedan ruler in India, who had about 150 wives. So Prabhupada was explaining how the man obviously had to go through a bit of a heavy schedule. So he explained that Nawab had a little cottage for each wife, 150 of them, around his palace. So Prabhupada was calculating. So just see, he would have to spend one night in each cottage so that each wife could see him. So that meant he'd do a circuit, and every 150 days, you know, the wife would get to see him because he had to do a full circuit of 150 cottages. So that's about almost a half a year before he came back to the original, you know, the wife we started from. But Krishna was not like that. He lived as a perfect householder, but he did it inconceivably, 16,008 wives. And each wife thought, Krishna's so attached to me more than the other wives. Each one was thinking, Krishna's perfectly bound to me. This is how expert Krishna was. These days, it's very difficult to satisfy one wife. But Krishna satisfies 16,108. So the Lord demonstrates all types of dharmas. He comes to establish that, to show both the gradual path of progress as well as the immediate path of progress. This is all part of Vedic culture. Vedic culture means gradual enlightenment and immediate enlightenment. How to cater to both speeds. Sometimes devotees, they wish that such a feature could be more prominent in our lives today. Sometimes devotees feel like, oh, it's all or nothing. Either you become a pure devotee tomorrow or else you lose. Either you take sannyas or you marry the next day. Why can't we recognize that it has to be, that many people want a more gradual path? That is recognized, but the problem is they have no human culture to gradually progress in. That's what brings the sense of urgency. They don't have Vedic culture to nurture them, nurse them, and bolster them. No, they're growing up in a totally murderous society. You can see that in spite of best intentions, it's so easy to get washed away. So contented. So it is not artificial to feel a sense of urgency. You have to be a bit intelligent and recognize the times and circumstances that you're living in. You don't have sages and brahmanas wandering everywhere. You don't have a government which understands that the purpose of, as Prabhupada writes here, the king had to see that the reserve energy of humanity was properly utilized. Human energy is meant not exactly for fulfilling animal propensities, but for self-realization. The whole government was specifically designed to fulfill this particular purpose. Well, as we were discussing yesterday, but now you can see the whole government is designed how to plunge people into sinful activities. The government will not embrace any religion. Oh, we are non-sectarian. We cannot become involved in sectarian religious beliefs. But the government will embrace gambling, it will embrace illicit sex, it will embrace abortion, it will embrace slaughterhouses. It will allow intoxication to go on. This is sectarianism. In other words, the government has sold out to materialism. So we do not say that the government has to enforce Krishna consciousness, but we do say the government has a right to present the best spiritual knowledge to the people. Then let the people choose. But the government has a right to present that, just like it presents nutrition information, like now they want to introduce genetically modified food into New Zealand. So there's various professors who are writing brochures on behalf of the New Zealand whatever agricultural ministry or whatever, and they have new brochures at supermarkets telling you, trust your government, genetically modified food is no problem at all, it's a great breakthrough, it simply leads to more progress. So people expect the government is supposed to do that. It's supposed to let us know what is good, what is bad, what is proper food, what is improper food. At the end of the pamphlet, the professor wrote that. And besides, why should you worry about genetically modified food? If there's any problem with food, it will not get into New Zealand because we have strict laws. The government prevents any bad food from coming in. So just by that, you should rest assured, nothing will be a problem. So people, they assume, yes, yes, a government is there to protect us and educate us. They don't understand what real protection and real education is. So just like the government is trying to educate people about even something like genetically modified food, why doesn't the government educate people about what is enlightenment? Why doesn't the government say, it is your job as a citizen to get the most profound knowledge of God available? So we don't expect, the government says to everyone, oh, you must chant Hare Krishna. But why doesn't it tell everyone that you should understand whether you are matter or spirit and get an education in that way? That's all we ask for. We just ask for a fair go. You should understand what is God. Now, if you call yourself a Christian, Muslim, whatever, then it should be seen that you're following your principles. It should be seen you have knowledge of God as given in your scripture, and you're following the principles of that scripture. So that's all we're asking. But people think, oh, you want a theocracy. Theocracy means a society controlled by religious principles. That's what down on it is. People say, oh, like Iran. We don't want that. We want democracy. What is so wonderful about democracy? You have a bunch of ignorant people voting, and they put into office ignorant people, and then the ignorant people in office cheat the other people who are not in office. That's all that goes on. People know that government leaders aren't qualified. Simply you run for office, you prance around in a way that attracts voters, and then you get the office, and then they say, now you are the Minister of Finance, or now you are the Minister of Defense, or now you are the Minister of Education. The person has no qualification except how to please voters. And then the people think, oh, why are we suffering so much? Why are things so bad? So what is so wonderful about democracy? Now, this is a very important point that Prabhupada makes in the purport. He's talking about how the king is responsible for not simply the prosperity of the people in a material way, but also the king is responsible for the people's spiritual development. So Prabhupada writes here, when these primary duties are properly discharged, there is no need of government of the people, by the people. This is an American slogan. They're very proud of it. I think it's in their Bill of Rights or Constitution or something. Government for the people, by the people, of the people. It's like a maha mantra. Prabhupada has incorporated it into the purport. You haven't been brought up on this propaganda, so you know, it's an American slogan, very bad. Government for the people, by the people, of the people. In God we trust.
So Prabhupada here is just knocking all that. What's the need of all this? Bruhaha, government of the people, by the people.
That means, if you go around in the States saying something like that, you can get in trouble because you can speak any kind of political nonsense you want. That's considered the great advantage of the USA. I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to death your right to say it. These are all American religious mantras. They're very bad about that, you know. I recently had in New York City, there was a big to-do because one political radical guy, an ethnic radical leader, was wanting to hold a big rally in the park in the city in which he was condemning all the other ethnic groups and telling his ethnic group he got to take over and like that. So the city denied him a permit for his meeting in the park. And so then there was a great protest that this is violating his constitutional rights. It's a very hallowed right in the USA, the right of public assembly, no matter what your beliefs are. So they took it to court, and the judge, he said, as despicable as the rhetoric that this leader speaks and will speak at his rally, just as despicable is the attempt to stop him from his right to speak in public. So, American religion. So, Prabhupada is just pushing all that aside. He had his expression, democracy is demon crazy. You have to know why he said that. It's not fanaticism. It's from understanding the obvious point that unless the voters are qualified, they'll never be able to recognize a real leader. So they'll just bring ruination upon themselves. So in the USA, you can go around and have a political rally about anything, saying, and normal mind, the mind, but it's not that they can curb you, because you're practicing your hallowed rights. But if you go around criticizing democracy, then they'll nail you. It's considered, mahapara. You can say anything, but do not criticize democracy. You can get on the list for being anti-democratic, and then they come after you. So, Prabhupada's just taking it head on in this purport. What's the need of this democracy? If the people are actually being taken care of, then why does everybody have to have a vote? The real point is the people are they being taken care of? Are they being protected by the government? Are they getting knowledge? Are their spiritual needs being looked after? If that's going on, then all glories. Why should the people worry about what the various policies are? Why should the people think they have to vote on everything? The people should be worried, am I getting the necessities? If you're getting the necessities, then all glories. And indeed, the system that Bhishma Dev is describing gives people their necessities. But these days, if you say, Iran, are these people in Afghanistan, the Taliban fighters or something, they want Islamic law, all the women have to be veiled up, and following the ancient law of the Quran. So that's what people think we're about. If you explain that the purpose of the government is to enforce religious principles, immediately they get very afraid. But if you tell the people the purpose of the government is open up casinos and legalize abortion and lower the drinking age, nobody gets afraid. So the purpose of the government is to enforce religious principles. Very barbaric, very primitive. The government deals with drinking and abortion and some gambling. Oh, yes. That's nice. No problem. This is the kind of situation we're living in today. Therefore, this Vedic knowledge is very relevant. It's not like we're just hearing ancient Hindu granny wisdom, which doesn't apply today. It does apply, but the problem is that it's not being applied, and therefore, people are suffering so much. Yudhisthira was concerned about suffering.
after the Battle of Kurukshetra. He was lamenting,
as we discussed yesterday.
Not only was he lamenting for the human beings, first of all, he wasn't lamenting simply for the men, he was lamenting for the women who lost all their husbands. And he was also lamenting for the animals too, all the horses and elephants that were killed in the battle. He saw them all as his subjects. So now, he's gone with the rest of the Pandavas to visit Bhishma Dev on his deathbed. Bhishma Dev is so great that Bhagavan Krishna is coming to see him at his moment of death. The supreme possessor of all happiness is coming to see Bhishma Dev in his last moment of death. This is the scene. This is how great Bhishma Dev is. And the Lord, by his arrangement, is allowing Bhishma Dev to console and his dear and teach him rather than Krishna himself. Bhishma Dev is demonstrating that your most glorious moment in life should be your death. Now, how many of us think that our most glorious moment would be death? No. I want to live and be happy and get things for me. I want to express myself. I want to be appreciated. I have a lot of things to do before I die. And once I feel appreciated and I feel like I've had enough happiness and pleasure, then I'll die in peace. Then I'll give up. No, it doesn't work that way. The more you gratify your material desires, the more attached you become. You cannot die in peace after a life of material involvement. You must die in great pain, but because people don't see that pain, they think people die in peace sometimes. You don't see what's going on with the subtle body, how the person is being ripped away from all their attachments, their beloved friends and family, their lifestyle, their situation. They're being ripped away from it. You can't see that. You just see the body, so you think they're having a peaceful death. No such thing. No such thing. How can there be peace when there's attachment? Because there's attachment, there must be great suffering, but you don't see it. Because we're not educated to see the subtle body, therefore we see the gross body and think, oh, she died peacefully in her sleep. Every sane person thinks about death. But in today's so-called culture, that's considered to be very negative. But here you're getting a whole chapter on the passing away of Bhishma Dev, his most glorious moment. Even the Supreme Lord is there watching. Whatever you have done in life will be tested at the time of death. And that's something we all share. It has been said that death is the great equalizer. Despite all the differences in bodies, male, female, beautiful, ugly, smart, stupid, all those bodies die. So therefore, our Vedic culture teaches you how to deal with death. And if you deal with it in the right way, it is your most glorious moment. We don't like to think about death. Even as devotees, we want to look forward to a life of devotional self-expression. We hope we'll have a nice family life surrounded by warm, loving children, warm, loving husband and wife, circle of devotee friends who appreciate us. We don't think that any moment of death can come. But that is the reality. So therefore, since Krishna consciousness deals with reality, we also discuss death. Srila Prabhupada said there are two kinds of kirtan, chanting Hare Krishna, and the other is discussing the miseries of material life. And both are kirtan, and both have to go on, otherwise the devotees will grow weak and go away. You may notice that it's so easy to forget what material life is about. When I say material life, I just don't mean living materialistic life. I also mean just living with a material body and forget what it's all about. It can end at any moment. Yesterday, Janani Vas was blessing me with a very ecstatic 2-hour presentation of his inspections of embalming places. Because he's a workplace safety specialist. He received a very Nictarian assignment. He has to go and see all the embalmers and make sure that they're doing their art without any safety violations. So it's a very educational experience for him. You know what embalmers do? They take dead bodies and they have to make them look pretty for the funeral. So he had to watch it all. He has to check their safety procedures. So the embalmers, they get the dead bodies from the hospital or the automobile accidents or whatever. Sometimes the bodies look okay, sometimes they're mangled. And the embalmer has to get them in shape for the funeral because people want to see the body looking good before they put it in the ground or burn it. So he describes me in that carrying process. I said, Johnny, guys, you should talk about this in class. This is great. Oh, no, man. I can't mention this in class. This is what we all need to hear. So I was asking questions for 2 hours. Tell me all about it. This is actually what goes on. I'll tell you. Okay. So here you are, dead body. You go to the embalmer. He lays you out on the table. And then they put an incision here and an incision there. So they try to get at your main circulatory system because they have to pump, you know, preservative chemicals into your circulatory system. So out from one side is spurting the blood. They drain that off. And then they replace the blood in your system with formaldehyde. You know, they're pumping you up with preservative chemicals. All right, so then they replace all the blood in you with preservative formaldehyde. But then, you've still got your organs in you, and organs, you know, they break down very quickly. So they got to remove all the organs from inside. So they cut up a slit in your abdomen, and they have this long rod with blades at the end, and they stick it up the slit, and they pulverize your heart and your lungs and your... pulverize the pieces of all your internal organs. Heart, lungs, stomach. And then when all that's reduced to pieces, nothing. This is what's going on. After it's all reduced to pieces, then they take a vacuum and suck it all out. So you're just totally empty of organs inside, even your brain. Yeah, brain too, gotta go. So you're just like basically a bag of flesh and bones pumped up with formaldehyde. And you know, they also put some additives in there to kind of make it look a bit rosy. So then you're ready for the funeral. Oh, other than that, they don't want your mouth opening. You're coming at the funeral. So they actually take screws and they bolt your mouth shut. And also, they don't want your eyes fluttering open. You know, you don't want to be at a funeral and all of a sudden, you know, the dead body just... So they actually, they put some kind of metal things under your eyelids to keep your eyes shut tight. And then you're ready for the funeral. The other one can take their last looks. So it's a very ghastly process. And we have to go through like about 15 of these places. and watch the guy do his art to make sure he's not violating any safety, you know, any safety principles. So sometimes the bodies come in good shape. Other times, you know, there's auto accidents. The guy's leg is missing, so the embalmer has to like attach, some kind of cardboard leg, just so, you know, so it looks like when the funeral is there, it looks like the guy actually still has his leg. Well, what else is there? Sometimes the person's, you know, had a head injury in the accident, and so you know, the bones have all broken, so their head's deformed, so the embalmer has to, like, pack the skull with some kind of, like, you know, synthetic substance just to fill out the shape. So they do all this. I told them, you should ask these guys, you know, their realizations of doing all this. So, this is what happens. Most people, they want to be embalmed, and they don't know what it's about. When someone dies, the undertaker is just saying, oh, you want to be embalmed? Yeah, whatever. Just no one can really think straight at that time when your loved one has died. So that's what happens. So it's 95-7. Have a meeting with devotees and get them to write wills saying they don't want to be embalmed because, you know, if your family might die and your parents would take you away or some relatives like that, and they're going to have all this done. And the problem is, if you're attached to the body, which a materialist is, though you shouldn't, as long as the body is lingering around, you're going to stick around as a ghost, watching it. So you can just understand what's happening, that they're making the dead body look pretty. How is the spirit soul wrapped in the subtle body going to peacefully or speedily take off to the next body? No. When you live your whole life in bodily attachment, you don't want to give up that body, you know it's dead. So you linger around in your subtle body. That's why in Vedic culture, immediately the body's burned. So that the person, you know, gets the hint. Move on. But as long as the body is there looking pretty, the spirit soul wants to stick around. Well, that's me, there's still hope. So in Vedic culture, they burn it, no hope. Get going. But in the gross demoniac society we have today, they want to preserve the body, and that means that the person who possessed that body wants to stick around. Oh, there's still hope. I look kind of rosy there. These things are basics in human civilization, but no religious activity. It is good to meditate on the demise of the body. Once I was telling Johnny about that. I was in Taiwan. I went to visit a morgue because it's a Buddhist country, and Buddhists are known to meditate on dead bodies to understand the impermanence of life. So I went to a morgue, and I told the morgue keeper, you know, I'm alone. You know, it's part of my meditation. I've got to see dead bodies. Oh, I understand. I'm right this way. Right? You can't do that here. Janani Das was telling me that in order to get into a morgue or a place like that where they work on dead bodies, you have to be police. No one, not even relatives behind it. So I had this nice opportunity of touring the city morgue in Taipei. And all these dead bodies in different rooms on metal stretchers, in these refrigerated rooms. Most of them were old, so God is giving me a tour, pointing out various characteristics of the bodies. Then we came on in a room, and there was like a 22-year-old girl laid out, you know, perfectly dressed. You couldn't even see any death marks on her. And then on stretchers next to her were two children. One was 2 years old, the other was 3 years old. They were also laying there in perfect shape. So the morgue keeper said to me, I can understand all these old men who died, but this I cannot understand. Just look at her. She's so beautiful. Look at those little children, so nice. How can this happen? This I cannot understand. They probably asphyxiated and they left the gas on in their flat or something like that. I cannot understand this. So I said, well, this is what I want to look at. I want to understand this. This is the thing to remember. That death is no respecter of any age. It's not that you have to be old to die. No, this is the real reality right here. Then while we were meditating on that, some fresh occupants came from car accidents. Certainly diminishes your material appetite. And that's what we need. We need our fever to come down. Therefore, the Vedic literature discusses impermanence as well as permanence. The Vedic literature discusses the glories of the spiritual world as well as the miseries of the material world. We have to hear both. And now you're sitting down hearing about the passing away, the death of Bhishma Day. You're hearing about someone dying. I'm sure you know that Srila Prabhupada instructed that his passing be recorded on film. And he would tell his disciples, don't think this is not going to happen to you. But we don't like to think like that. We like to meditate on, where is my creative opportunities? Where is my opportunity for recognition and appreciation? Have I experienced all that I'm due to experience with this body? The death doesn't respect your hopes. Death respects its own schedule. Vishnudeva is showing how to die perfectly. That is the greatest contribution of Vedic knowledge. How to die so that you achieve the supreme destination. In order to die in that way, you have to live your life in that way. So those who are intelligent, they live in such a way that they're always thinking of Krishna. Therefore we have the deities. They're there to increase your meditation upon Krishna. And Prabhupada writes at the end of the purport that the deity worship is especially for householders. Now you may notice he talks about installing the deity of the Lord at home. You have to understand the context of that point. If you have no access to install deities in the temple, then you can worship the deity at home, but the standard has to be very high. I remember once Prabhupada was coming out and saying, now all my disciples, since they started going to India, they're going to India and bringing back, their murtis and worshiping them at home. But he said, that will not suffice. But the only way you can consider your deity worship at home to be as beneficial as going to the temple is if the deities at home are worshipped on the same standard as those in the temple. So that means everyone in the family has to beyond the standard of a temple brahmana. Not only the husband, wife, but also the children. And every day they have to follow the puja. Not, well, I have to do a business trip, or we have to go visit our relatives, and then, no, it can't be like that. So if you do all that, he said, then you can say your home deity worship is very spiritually productive, just like worshiping the Archivigo out in the family. In other words, he was saying, I doubt that any of you all will be able to do that. He pointed out the example of rich families in India, in which if someone didn't come to Mangal Arati, you get fined. And if they had to go away for a business trip, someone would have to stay behind and take care of the deities. It was just too bad for the business. Somebody had to stay behind. The Prabhupada was explaining that's how the rich, wealthy families in India would. They would always have us. Room in their house designated as the temple room, and the deity worship would go on without fail. And everybody in the family was expected, once they were beyond the age of 12, to be spiritually qualified enough to worship the deity. So we have our deities here, and it's a shame that sometimes worshiping them feels like a burden. We should know that the deities are here to give us a vision of Vaikuntha, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to purify us. In the early days of Krishna consciousness on the Second Avenue in New York, one devotee asked Prabhupada, how can a householder conquer lust? It seems to be impossible. And Prabhupada wrote that the way you conquer Mr. Lust is by deity worship. When the householder is engaged in deity worship, they're tending to someone else's mind. They're dressing the Lord. They're looking after the Lord's comforts. And that is how they become glorified. So especially for the householders, the deities are different. For traveling preachers, not so necessary. They're supposed to be enlivened by the activities of Karanath, poetry, times, and mission. And Prabhupada expressed concern from time to time. Sannyasis traveling duties, it could be burdensome, could interfere with the preaching. Of course, it's
many persons traveling along and with the other things, that's another thing. My Prabhupada's concerned with one sannyasi, with two sannyasis traveling and just by themselves and trying to do all the duty worship. He made that point. The duty worship is especially for householders. And householders, they have to look at it as their great opportunity to directly serve the Lord of the spiritual world. Any questions? Yes.
Glad you could have been glad to hear how many of you just think of the time of threatening to do that thing. You were saying that.
I think I know what you're referring to. That the devotees who were visiting were commenting that it's wonderful. It's always like this, is the temple always packed every day. And I explained that it's mostly a Grihastha temple, and so therefore they don't come every day because they're taking the care of their families, they're working like that. So I wasn't offering any editorial comment on anything else. You can't, fanatically judge everyone. Some persons, their situation doesn't allow it. They work. Their home situation, their children don't allow it. They can't come over there. You just can't automatically dismiss them. I think everyone can see who is sincere and who's trying their best. So the child in the womb is hearing. Now modern science is recognizing that. I just saw yesterday some scientific news that they're experimenting, playing music to the child in the womb and somehow measuring the brain reactions. And you're seeing that there is a reaction. So we're giving the child in the womb the best music we found in human Bhagavatam. We don't need to do all these scientific experiments. You can read in the Bhagavatam now. Paramahas heard Bhagavatam within the womb of his mother. Shukadeva Goswami heard Bhagavatam within the womb. In our mystery first. Temples where they're mostly householders, they have to be a bit flexible because they're not being paid by the temple. They're not being supported by the temple. So you have to allow that they sort out their lives as best they can. And it is a struggle. But it's a wonderful struggle because the whole point is how to keep Krishna in the center of the family. It's not that they're just struggling to pay the bills. That's very boring. But they're struggling how to keep the household shipped together and focused on Krishna. So Krishna will bless them. So everyone's situation is different. It's not like all the families are supported by the temple. Just like when I was a new devotee, if a householder didn't show up for the morning program, you knew. He or she. It was just unheard of. But they were all supported by the temple. Some of them had to go to work. Some were working. Gopal Krishna Maharaj, he was a householder and he was working a corporate job. But then the charity, he was a corporate worker. But everyone else, they were all supported by the temple. So, they didn't have to adhere to a work schedule, so why not come to the temple? So that was the expectation. So-and-so didn't come to the temple. Never mind, we had a family. Everyone knew he's out. He's on his route. And you were always right. If someone stopped coming just for one day, you knew they were, that means they're about to leave. You can't say that now because the devotees have to look after their family situations, but they can't.
while keeping Krishna in the center. So we want to encourage everyone. Those who are more conscientious, well, you'll see them more. But sometimes, you know, persons may not come as much, but they're still sincere devotees. Well, it has to be seen in the whole picture. Because people have children, and to bring up children these days is very difficult. So therefore I don't, you know, make judgments who's coming and who's not coming. It's nice that everyone comes as much as they can. And I think amongst the senior devotees, everyone knows who's coming as much as they can and who has certain situations. And maybe inquisition. Capital punishment is okay. you think this would be? I don't know. Any other questions? Yes. That's why God is in the fire. Arjuna asked the same question to Krishna. I'm bewildered. First you tell me this, and then you tell me that. First you say it's best to get knowledge, and then you say act without being attached to the results. I'm bewildered about it. Arjuna asked that very question. And so therefore Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is teaching him how to act in such a way, both according to his temporary designation and his eternal designation. That's the brilliance of Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, it's a great mistake for devotees to stop reading Bhagavad Gita. You miss out on seeing the brilliant answer to the enigma of handling your temporary nature and your eternal nature. Ultimately, Krishna ends up firmly on the side of the eternal. Abandon all other dharmas and just take the real dharma of pleasing me. Guidance is required. It's very tricky how to act in this world to get the eternal benefit by using temporary things. Without guidance, it's not possible. So we're speaking. And a great mistake householders make is they just go off on their own. Oh, no one understands our situation. We're unique. We've got to sort this one out for ourselves. And then when we sort out on our own, then we'll, you know, come back and just and be with devotees. That's a great mistake. There's nothing unusual or special. It's all always the same old thing. So our householders have to learn to support one another. That means you cannot be afraid to reveal your mind. Oh, you know, just so many economic worries. Have you ever been through this before? How do you handle it? Oh, I've got two kids. I can't chant. Everyone is like it, right? No one chants in the kids. You have to have support to bounce things off of. Just like we're having persons getting married here. They need advice. Of course, they have to want to take advice. Why should we reinvent the wheel every year? It's really, that's the unenlivening thing to see. Every year the wheel gets reinvented. People get married and act like no one got married before. People try to be brahmacharis and act like no one ever tried to be a brahmachari before, so no one knows what they're doing. No. We should be taking the benefit of so much experience in the past. For those who are getting married, you should discuss the serious married couples. And what are the pitfalls, what's expected? I remember asking one brahmachari up north, he told me, okay, so I think in a year I'll be ready to marry. I said, okay, very nice. Now, what are you going to do? What am I going to do? My wife and I will just live in a van and travel around, just like I do now. But really. So So you think your wife is going to be happy just, you know, the two of you living in a van. Yeah, why not? Isn't that sold out? No. Where's the money coming from? Yeah, she's going to want a house. Yeah, she's going to want kids, you know. What are you going to do about that? Well, we need experienced householders to explain reality. Most persons in the past got married and didn't have a really good idea of what they were getting into. They didn't have any idea what female or male nature is like. The men expected the women were going to be like them. We are rational, supposedly, and the women are going to be rational. And the women expected the man, he's going to, you know, he understands that we want certain things, and he's going to fulfill those things, and that's the way it'll be. Adibol. And we don't have to worry about income because the temple will support us. And so now we've been through all those phases. So therefore, those who have experience should advise the younger ones who are just setting out in this way. Just like we've had experience with people, you know, pretending to be brahmacharis. And it just causes a social disturbance to themselves individually and to the community of devotees. So we try to point things out now so that people don't have to repeat the same tribulations. And that requires guidance. But in order to give guidance, you have to be fixed in Krishna consciousness. When you have unqualified persons giving guidance, household life means quite a bit of Maya. You have those kind of persons giving advice, then you got habits. And so, then your community is destroyed. But if you have qualified persons in the various ashrams giving advice, that makes things very strong. And of course, people have to be willing to take the advice. Otherwise, in the past, it's been, I've got my man, I've got my girl, we're just going to sort this one out ourselves. Now they both move, see the festival time. That shouldn't be like that. We should all have a few persons we can get advice from. This is a great weakness, that we don't have persons we can take advice from. Find someone, experience, and take advice from them. Oh, you're just getting married? Well, these are the pitfalls. These are things you should look out for. These are things you have to do. Not that you just take off in a happy wonder and at last. Especially, you know, if in the process of getting yourself married, you happen to fall in love at the same time. You know, that's double trouble. And you're totally bewildered. You definitely need advice then. So our community will become very strong when it's capable of giving advice to the brahmacharis, to the grihasthas. But the person had to be qualified. Otherwise, when people start giving advice and they're not qualified, they cause great havoc. So the temple should recognize those who have some qualification to give advice in the different ashrams and make an arrangement that people get advice. Some kind of counseling system. Because the worst thing is when everybody thinks, I'll sort it out for myself. And a lot of times what they do when they say they'll sort it out for themselves, they immediately look for somebody who's weak and say, well, what did you do? How did you deal with this? Because they're thinking, I don't want to reveal my mind to the strict devotees. They won't really understand. So because the strict devotees don't understand, you need to look for some weak persons. Oh, yeah. So I always notice that when somebody's like that, they immediately establish networks with other weak persons, and then they start exchanging advice how to be weak. Because the strict devotees don't understand. This is nonsense. Look at someone who is successful in executing their ashram and ask them for advice. That's basic humility. Don't act like, you know, some bird that, you know, sees a food scrap that it's been longing for so long and swoop down and grab the food stuff and fly away. Okay, I got to see that flavor. No. That's a sure path to problems. So we don't want to reinvent the wheel every year. We want the younger devotees to take advantage of the experience of the older devotees. But the older devotees have to be qualified, not just, I'm an older devotee, therefore you should listen to me. One devotee was telling me, he said, I just look at the guidance some of these young devotees are getting these days, and I just feel so bad. Why wasn't it there for me? I told him, you should never lament that, you did so much service in the past. It's not to your disadvantage. Krishna has noted that although things weren't as developed in the past as they are now, although everyone was younger back then, and so in one sense mistakes were made, on the other hand, you were so engaged in devotional service, that's to your internal credit. Don't lament. Is it Abhay Charan, the Dole investigator? He was telling me, this has always been working, supporting his family. So he was telling me, 20 years ago, he was on the down list. Everybody was, he works, He's not a real devotee. He's, he doesn't live in the ashram. He doesn't get, his family isn't supported by the temple. He's a fringy. He's a, he's a lower species. So he had to put up with that. He didn't agree with it, but he had to put up with it. He said, now I've got to put up with the other extreme. Everyone's coming to me, offering their obeisances. You are the real Mahatma. You've really been doing your bhakti. You've been working all these years. You've been setting the standard. You are the great. And so he doesn't agree with that either. So he just watched his things over what extreme is the other. So he said, I don't know why they say that now. He said, the way I feel that I missed out. Due to my family situation, I missed out on ashram years. I missed out on taking part in marathons. He said, these guys are coming to me, praising me now. Yeah. When 20 years ago I was condemned for trying to support my family, now they're praising me. But I'm thinking, you guys were so fortunate. You had your ashram years. I never tasted a marathon. I never tasted what it's like to, just live very simply in an ashram. That's what he thinking. But now he's gone. You are the real standard. You are the real Mahatma. You've been working 20 years. You own your house. You have 2 cars. That's real Mahatma. Prabhupada, please. This is what Prabhupada wants. He's the first to say, oh, I don't know. I'm just trying to hold my family together and, make them Krishna conscious. I wish I could have done some ashram years, but I was too attached back then, and now I've got 3 kids, and so I'm just trying to push on the best I can. That's the way he looks at it. Meanwhile, he's got all these, this is the way they go. Look at me. If I had only done what you did, if I had done that 20 years ago, I would have had my own home, I would have had my 2 cars, I would have had my garage. Just get out of your service. But look at our devotees who have done service in the ashram and the old marathon style service. They're doing okay. They have their houses, they have their families. They don't look starving to me. Somehow the Krishna takes care of you. It's amazing. It's quite amazing. Somehow the Krishna takes care of you. It may be a simple standard, but you have a roof over your head, you're not starving, and you're able to chant Hare Krishna and go back to Godhead.
Somebody else?